So here we are again, or maybe for the, you know, not again for some of you, but today we're going to carry on covering the major points of this course to Buddhahood. You know, grade one, grade two, we graduate. So yesterday we did junior school, the first two scopes of the Lam Rim, if you know that term. Today we're going to do high school, university and postgraduate. Squeeze it all in together. So we think we're going to listen to these ideas coming from the Buddha. Whether you've heard them once or 1,000 times, hear them as if you've heard it for the first time, and hear it freshly, hear it as advice. You don't have to take the advice, but it is advice. You decide what advice you want to take, because you're the boss. You're in charge of your life. And advice for what? Well, two things. One is to develop our own amazing potential for clarity and wisdom and all these things. Why? So that for our benefit. And then, of course, for the benefit of others, because we all live in this crazy planet together, you know. So that we can develop our amazing potential. We're going to listen to these teachings so we can develop our amazing potential for our sake and the sake of others. Thinking like that. Sanghe charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chon yen gipe sonam ki drola penche sanghe drubha shog sanghe charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chon yen gipe sonam ki drola penche sanghe drubha shog sanghe charang soke chognam la jang cho badu Badu dagni kyab su chi, dagi chon yen gipe sonam ki, drola penchir sangye drubha shog. So just to summarize Friday night and yesterday.
Excuse me,
Venerable. Yes?
We just need to dismiss the children to their class.
Dismiss. Release. Goodbye, you guys. I'll see you later. Bye-bye. Why didn't they go sooner? Why did you wait for me to start before they left?
They sit for the prayer.
Oh, you do? Okay. Oh, my goodness. They have to. Okay, good. I didn't realize. Goodbye, sweethearts. Good. Okay. So to summarize, and we talked about Friday night and yesterday, the tradition anyway among the teaching in the Tibetans is when you give a teaching and then the next day you repeat it two more times. Once a bit shorter and then even shorter, because then it goes in more deeply. We need to do that, reiterating all the time. So here we are, what we're discussing here is this package of Buddhist teachings, and that's a really perfect way to put it. Things, we package things, you know. So the package here is known, as we must be familiar, in this Tibetan concept, this Tibetan phrase, Lam Rim, path, gradual. Now we hear that, the words we can hear, a gradual path. We've got to think, well, I wonder what that means, you know? But as soon as we hear, for me, the term, it means a course, we go, oh, I get that, because we know a course is gradual. Junior school, high school, university, postgraduate. We get that completely. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama said that. It's like education system. But again, as I always say, it surprises us to think that a spiritual path is that. We know that learning violin and cooking is that. But we think something weird about spiritual. But in fact, it's exactly the same. So when we hear it that way, it's very sobering, you know. Because then we know where to begin, what the middle bit is, and we know where we're at. And actually, if you really understood this package, this course, this gradual path, even just intellectually, you open any book, I'll do it, Buddhist book obviously, at any page, and you read a sentence, five aggregates, that you know you get, you learn that in junior school. Then you see our own projections, you know that's high school, it's all about the mind. You read a word, oh, compassion, that's university. You go, oh, mantra, that's postgraduate. So when you know that, suddenly all the Buddhist teachings would seem like this big lump of confusion to us, all plonked together, but it's got a shape and a structure, you know. It's extremely helpful. And until we get that, but it's like any body of knowledge. If you're learning music and you just don't know where you're at, you can't tell, and you open up a music book, and all the, you know, grade one is here, then there's a grade seven, then there's a grade three, of course you're confused. But we all know whether it's music or mathematics, it's orderly, it's presented in an orderly, gradual, incremental. Gradual according to what? The disciple's capacity, it's obvious. And that's what they say in the 14th century. And Islamazopa, who respects the tradition, translates beautifully the first scope of teachings, as they call it, junior school, are the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. I mean, it sounds very kind of verbose, but that's called junior school. Then you get to high school. That's the teachings and practices suitable to the person of the middle capability. It's just their way of putting it. When we understand it in our own words, we get it, instead of just repeating those words without understanding them. And then we go to the great scope, as they call it. That's the teachings and disciple and practices suitable to the disciple of the greatest capability. So the first part is, you know, this analogy I like to use, which I think is great. A bird needs two wings. So the wisdom wing is all the nuts and bolts of junior school and high school, which are the teachings that we do to help us develop our amazing potential. And it's in and the main beneficiary of all that practice, of course, is ourself. We're not used to thinking this way, but it's so important to understand that. And that's what we've discussed so far. Only just junior school. So then we have to look at the different points in the Lam Rim, but we have got to get the essence of each of these stages, the essence of it. So the essence of junior school is the practice of the practice of ethics, which in Buddhist terms is called abiding by the laws of karma. So we talked about that yesterday, tried to bring it down to earth, and had very good discussions. And so let's repeat these things, just repeat. So but before that, some preliminary practices that prime our minds to even get us to want to enter into this course. So that's when we hear the classic one, the very first point that Tsongkhapa presents is if you're going to become a Buddha, that's the end result. So look, I started with that, and this is why I find this so tasty, the word Buddha. In Tibetan, Sangye, the etymology is really tasty. I repeat this continuously, and it's powerful to hear it, because it implies the methodology. The end result, you graduate as this Buddha, Sangye. So Sang implies the utter eradication from our own mind, our very being, every atom of neurosis, negativity, misery, depression, anxiety, ego grasping, you name it, the stuff that we are intimately familiar with, and which in our models of the mind, in our psychology, in our neuroscience, in our world, we consider completely normal parts of a normal person, to the point that you'd be a wacko if you didn't have them. Honestly, I mean, it's just too weird to even hear these words. We can't conceptualize it. But this is what Buddha has found to be possible. Not only that, yay, implies the development to perfection of all the other stuff. And what's that? That's the good stuff. Compassion, wisdom, love, blah, blah. It's almost, the concept is almost so simple. That's the end result. And where does that come from? Mr. Buddha, 2,500 years ago, who did the job. So like we talked yesterday, which is crucial to understand, and this implies our entire relationship with the Buddha throughout our path. You know, Buddha is not a creator. I always quote this one scientist in New Zealand. I remember this question, the only person who's ever asked me this question, and we all ask the same questions. This is the only one time I've ever had it. This man happened to be a scientist, and he said, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? Which is a perfect question if you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew. Perfect. But then he was shocked when I said, would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? Of course we wouldn't. We would laugh hysterically. Because we know that Einstein used his own noggin. Do we say that in America? Noggin? Okay. He used his own noggin, which of course in the Buddhist view, this astonishing thing we call the mind, which we're going to really talk about in depth this morning. This amazing mind of ours that has these much more subtle levels, much more powerful subtle levels of cognition that we have to access, that the Buddha has done that job and has seen the way he says the reality is. So his, what he has presented is what he has done himself. Like if I were Einstein, you know perfectly well that I'm presenting to you what I have found to be true. I wouldn't say, well, I think it's possibly true. You'd ask me to shut up until I'm certain. Isn't it? Don't confuse you. I wouldn't say, well, you know, I had a dream last night. I had a vision of this. It was revealed to me. You'd chuck me out the door. See, that's what we think of as religion. And I'm not being rude about that, because that's true if you're a Christian. Because it is coming from on high. It's coming from being called God who created the universe. That's completely appropriate. And that's what we tend to think of as religion. But no, creator religions. Buddhism is not like that. It's sometimes a shock for us to hear this. Buddha's not a creator. He doesn't assert a creator. He says we don't need creating. We do a fine job making our own mess and developing our own marvelous qualities. It's up to us. We're the boss. That's, for me, the best way to put it. So Buddha then has done this job of becoming himself a Buddha. So basically all his teachings, what else are they but his methodology? It's pretty obvious. So where does all this come from? Buddha's mind. But it's hard for us to hear this. We don't get it. You know, so it's very fascinating to remember this. It's important to get this clear. That implies our relationship with the Buddha. It implies our relationship with Einstein. If you have a question, you go to check it out. Because he tells you, yeah, I found this and not that. Same with the Buddha. Buddha's not our creator. You don't go to Buddha for forgiveness. You don't go to Buddha for praise. You don't go to Buddha for punishment. That's how we think of a creator, and that's fine. That's that model, not the Buddhist. There's no creator, no punisher, no rewarder. It's very shocking to hear it like this. That's how we talked yesterday about karma, the law of karma. That every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs us, produces the person we are and produces the person we become. We are the one who does it. This is a very powerful concept. That's the Buddha's view. And it was around in that amazing world well before the Buddha. These amazing dudes, well before the Buddha, these Indian guys, as His Holiness said, more than 3,000 years ago, they're the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. We probably thought it was Freud, being so smart in our culture. No, these amazing beings. And if we look into deeply the meaning, which we're going to get into this morning, the mind, it's mind-bogglingly fascinating, I tell you. So the essence of genius, so the first part, the preliminaries to prime us, the first point Tsongkhapa presents, if we're going to become this Buddha, Sangye, we better find a person who can lead us there. You don't go and ask a tennis player to show you baseball. You know, you've got to check out who is a person of knowledge, who is a knowledge holder, a Rigsin in Tibetan, it's a wonderful term, knowledge holder. We better find the right person to show us. If you want to get to Buddha, if you want to get to tennis, you find a tennis player. If you want to get to Christianity's view of heaven, don't ask a Buddhist. Go find a Christian teaching. You've got to, so of course we've got to find out. Many of us, we don't know what we want, so we've got to check it out. Go listen. And then we've got to know what they're going to teach us. Where's the end? What's the end result, you know? What you're going to graduate as? This is why it's so fascinating. There are so many views in the world, and I find this marvellous. I would never criticise any one of them. I mightn't agree with them. I would happily debate with them. But it's so clear they're different. Often we have this yearning to think they're all the same. It's just naive. It's kind of wanting, that concept of, what do they call it? Esperanto. No one ever speaks it, I don't think, on the whole planet. We like our own language, our own style, our own way of doing things. Nothing wrong with that. But mind our own business and don't shove it down other people's throats. You know? It's so important, this. I remember in Kathmandu years ago, some Lutherans, lovely people, came and wanted to know all about Buddhism. So I didn't try to say, oh, yeah, it's all the same. I told them the differences, and they were fascinated. Well, one of the first ones was really amazing to me. It was a wonderful response. This man, when I told him about karma and how there's no boss, there's no punisher, there's no rewarder, there's no creator, there's no one watching over running the show, he was really shocked. He said, how come there's not anarchy among Buddhists? That's a profound point. It's an amazing question. The implication is we need policing. Well, the Buddha says, we are our own policemen. We are the one who brings our own results by our own actions and own thoughts. This is intense. We're so addicted to the dualistic view of punishment and reward, why we think that's why we constantly want to be seen to be a good girl and not to be seen as a bad girl. oh, I got away with that one. This is insanity. That's coming from ego grasping, a complete mistake. We'll discuss this more today. So the view of karma is the essence of junior school. But before that, if I want to become a Buddha, I need a teacher. You've got to find a Rigsen. You know? And that's up to us to check. Check. Use our common sense. Look at their behavior. Listen to their teachings. Listen to their words. Look at their students. That's powerful. Their students are the proof of the pudding, you know? Listen to what their peers say. Look at their reputation. We need to do this, because what else can we do? We're going to jump in the deep end and go do a course for, you know, if it's even a music course, a few years and you discover you've got the wrong teacher. I mean, I remember that vividly. The first time in my life I realized the necessity for a teacher. At a point in my life when I was seriously thinking, I'm the one who has to do it, which is a good part of our progress. And I was in New York. I mean, it was my first time in America in the mid-70s, and I was into martial arts. Loved it, you know. So I found this, and I was a feminist at the time, and I wanted a female dojo. I wanted a female teacher and a dojo of women, which had nothing wrong with that. But that was my basis, my main basis for choosing a teacher. So I found this dojo. It was great. We always laughed because we looked outside and it was next door to Dyke's Lumber. And just now I was dry, because then at the time all these radical feminists, you know, so we thought it was wonderful, Dyke's Lumber, just outside the door, you know. I remember driving through Brooklyn recently, I saw Dyke's Lumber. They must have moved from Wall Street, because we used to be down Wall Street. Anyway, never mind. So all I know is I had a wonderful time for a year studying there. And I loved martial arts. Every day of the week I'd study. And it was great. So then I went back to Melbourne, Australia, and I wanted to continue my karate. So I decided I'd continue. Obviously, it was a certain style. I forget even the name now. So I went to one, and it was this club. And I said I was in the green or the red or whichever belt it was. I forget. So I went into that belt, and after the first class, he was very polite, the teacher, and he said, I think you better go back to the white belts. Well, I was really insulted and hurt and offended. I'd worked so hard for 1 year, gotten that belt. But then I thought about it. It was the first time in my life. It was very powerful. I realized I needed a teacher. I'd chosen the wrong teacher for the wrong reason. She was a nice person, but she didn't know karate well. So I learned wrongly for a year. This was nothing. This karate for a year, wrong. But that was the power. That was the teaching for me. Powerful. Huge. Check up. Be so careful. And of course, with this world, with every second Joe will start a Buddhist center. I mean, I can tell you two examples of shocking examples and of how foolish we are. You know, there's one person in California who invited me to come to his center about 50 miles out of Los Angeles. And it was a little Zen group. A lovely man, dear man, very kind, very sweet, young man, had his group. He lovely people. I gave a couple of teachings. I saw his website. And then gradually, when I got to know him more and more, emails would be coming. He was just kind of weird. And I discovered in the end, one student wrote and had all their worries about him. He seemed to lie all the time. I discovered he was this chronic, serious, mentally ill liar. He had lived in a fantasy world. One minute an email would come that his parents were dead. Well, his parents were alive. This girl had seen them last week. One minute you hear that he has a husband. Then he had a wife and two children. I mean, I was demented. But when you saw him, he was quite a sweet man with a good mouth. He was charismatic. People liked his words. Then I started to listen to some of his teachings online. He was just demented. He was just quoting words. It was astonishing. And then because he thought I was one of his teachers, then he started telling people that I was his best special teacher. I'd give him personal teachings. And then he was in India and he came and he gave special teachings to 500 people with me. Everything was just made up bizarre, bizarre nonsense. So I had to expose him very quickly to his board for things I knew and listed them and wrote him very directly. Well, of course, he got shocked and just rejected me, and half the people accepted because they'd seen it, but people continued to trust him, in spite of the evidence. It's very fascinating, you know, it was so nakedly obvious. He said he was a monk. One day he suddenly showed up with Tibetan robes, you know. Well, where'd you get take robes? He made up some story about some lama. I didn't question him, but I thought about it. It was all just made up, everything. The same in Australia. There's a woman who wore robes, who said she was a nun, gives talks everywhere. She was a psychiatrist. She knew this, she knew that. She didn't. It was all lies. But people believed her because her mouth was powerful. This is very interesting, isn't it? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. There was a man in New York, an Indian man from the continent of India. I know his ex-girlfriend. And he's well known, I think. He made a video. He pretended to be a Hindu guru. He had an ashram. He gave teachings. It was an experiment to prove that people will believe anything they're told when it's spiritual. So then he exposed it as a joke. Not a joke, as an experiment. People, of course, are furious with him. They ask him to be his guru and all that stuff. He was just pretending. So these are really naked examples of demented people. But that's why we have to check. And we all think we're intelligent. We all think because we believe what we see. So this is the point when those two people, that woman and that man, who had good mouths, people liked their words. Millions of people loved Hitler's words. You remember, look at that. It's astonishing. He was so powerful, so charismatic. Okay, that's all karmic connection. But we're lulled into that. Because someone's charismatic, they must be special. And this is the point that's so unbelievable. We'll go into this morning about the mind. If we feel good, we assume the thing that caused it must be good. This is the worst mistake we can make. And I wish we had more time. We can go into the mechanics of how the mind works. This is the worst mistake that leads us up garden paths, you know. It's unbelievable. So choosing a teacher, so important. First step. Then, of course, Tsongkhapa gets us to think about, to prime us, to want to bother to practice, to think of how fortunate we are. You know, people do this on the internet all the time. We're part of the North 1%. Not rich, but fortunate. This is exactly the little list, the checklist that Tsongkhapa gets us to go through. How fortunate. We're reasonably sane, reasonably healthy. We've got enough money in the bank. We've got a job. We've got people. We've got sanity. We've got clarity. We've got access to teachings. All these conditions that we just take for granted, but in fact are the fruit of our unbelievable past virtue. If we realize this, we'd be blissed out, I tell you. But like we talked yesterday, we take things for granted. Then, of course, now we're ready to enter into Grade 1 Junior School, and we did this yesterday, going into impermanence, which gives us a wake-up call, you know, I could die at any moment. So what's going to happen after death? I could have suffering rebirth. Then what do you do? Oh, my God, I don't want that suffering. Whom do I turn to? Take refuge. Then we abide by Buddha's instructions, and this is now the law of karma. That's the essence of Junior School, abiding by the laws of karma. What does that mean? So the very minimum level, Buddha says, as Lama Zopa said, the most urgent practice. You want to practice? Don't worry about crossing your legs or your eyes or something and sitting there or whatever. I mean, I'm not being sarcastic. The first practice is back off and control your mouth and control your body and don't harm sentient beings. This is the most important one. Please hear me literally. According to these instructions, that's junior school. Watching your mind is high school. Nothing wrong, try to do both. But to the extent that you can't control your body and speech, you cannot see your mind. It is logical. Control your behavior first. Why should I? Because Buddha's view of karma is that everything I think and do and say programs my mind, puts seeds in my mind that will produce me of the future. I create myself. I'm this work in progress. This is intense. So of course I don't want suffering in the future. And this is exactly the view we have about food. You go to your doctor, you've got real serious diabetes for a bit. No, what is that? I've got really high cholesterol. People give you all these warnings, all this advice. You don't want future suffering. So anyway, I happened to check out. I put those dye in my veins. You know the dye they put in your veins? And they discovered I'm 1 in 100 lucky people whose cholesterol sails right through their arteries. And less than 10% stays, so I can have as much bad cholesterol as I like. I'm okay. So I got off that one. But normally you go, oh my God, I don't want that suffering. And that's so logical. You don't go to the teacher, the doctor, how dare you tell me what to do. You're so happy they give advice. And why do you take their advice? Because you don't want future suffering. We get that concept. But when it comes to being born in the lower realms, we say, that's a superstition, rubbish. When we come to even thinking that lying and stealing will harm me and I'll continue to lie and steal, no, that's ridiculous. I'm allowed to say what I like, we say. We're kind of demented when it comes to, we're very okay up here, but here we've lost the plot, you know. I remember one time when we say, I can say what I like, I can think what I like. We even say, I can think what I like. The assumption being there's no consequences, that it brings no result. Which is nihilism. And I always remember this. I saw my computer years ago and I looked on the news in the New York Times. And this woman in Brooklyn had gotten into her husband's computer. And she discovered he was part of a cannibal site. And they were planning to kill and eat her. It's very funny, isn't it? I mean, it's shocking, isn't it? She didn't just call the police. She called the FBI. It was more serious, you know. So anyway, the point here is really hilarious. His lawyer, his position of defense was, he's allowed to think like this. That doesn't mean he's going to do it. I mean, this really is schizophrenic, I think, when we even know without being a Buddhist and what I do, if I'm sitting there being angry every day, I don't think I'm going to turn into a happy person. I think it's fairly evident. So how can a person who's going to that level of fantasy, preparing to do that, how could, you know, could we just think it's okay, there's no consequences? But the Buddha's point is, every millisecond of what goes on in our mind, and what we say, and what we do, because saying and doing are just the servants of what's in the mind, you know, they carry out the mind's wishes. So we have to watch our body, speech and mind like a hawk, but body and speech first, please. Body and speech first. And even the result of that, we forget it, you know, forget the rats and cockroaches who will have a party, as Lama Zopa says, because you leave them in peace, because you're not killing them, but we are the beneficiary. We've got to get this point. We gloss over this one. This is for our benefit. You become this marvelous, controlled, disciplined, content person when you control your body and speech. Urgent first level. First level, at least don't harm others. Then we begin to realize that also means maybe I won't eat six pieces of cake. Maybe I won't jump on every girl I like to see. I forget the human. Sorry, that's the first level. Don't misuse your body to harm others. But then you start to realize, well, I mightn't, you know, the actions that only harm you, because they all harm me. That's the point. So beginning to harness our body and speech. And for us, our speech. We don't go around raping and killing too many people. I would think not. But our speech, like we talked yesterday, we don't think it matters. We vomit out whatever we think, whether it's true or not, whether it's kind of making people happy or not. We abuse, and especially bad-mouthing behind backs, even if we're nice people. It's the worst one. I've seen in Buddhist centers, the cause of schisms in a center, good Buddhists, because they talk about each other behind backs and then take sides. That's the politics. This is the worst thing. So beginning to control our body and speech is entry-level junior school, and so beneficial. Then it's easy-peasy to start to meditate and see your mind, which we're going to now talk about today. Easy then. But if you've got uncontrolled body and speech, it's obvious. It's obvious. You've got no space to see your mind. Because, you know, as soon as you feel anger, it vomits out the mouth. It's too late. So harnessing the speech doesn't mean you suffocate it, but you discipline. Zip the lip. Keep our hands to ourselves. This is profound. The essence of karma is that, way more than that, but that's the fundamental. And as we discussed yesterday, the second most urgent level of karma, so first is to stop sowing more negative seeds, like stop sugar now, Ravina. Stop sugar in this second. And then you've got to start cleaning up the rubbish that you've already eaten before it starts manifesting as diabetes. So we've got to clean up the past karma before it manifests as suffering. It's just common sense, you know. So that's purification, like we talked yesterday. This is junior school. And you can die with a happy mind. Because why? Because you've just programmed yourself to continue getting another decent rebirth so you can bop along carrying on your spiritual path and then maybe get to high school and university, postgraduate, like that. Now let's look at high school. The middle scope, as they call it. This is where we actually do the essential job of being a Buddhist, which is the unique one of understanding the Buddha's view of the mind, which is, it is unique. When we hear the words like love, compassion, attachment, anger, that's not unique, we think. But his view of the mind is amazing, I tell you. If you really study it, get down to the bones of it. And it's utterly unique and profoundly different in many ways from the way we think about the mind, even though we all use the same words. So like we talked, first of all, yesterday, I mean, the very first point I mentioned yesterday, too, if we're going to become a Buddha, which part of us becomes a Buddha is the mind. So we better get clear what Buddha's view of the mind is. So let's reiterate that point this morning, okay? Because this is now where we get into the mind in more depth. And the framework here for this is the Four Noble Truths. So let's look at that. The Four Noble Truths. Or the Four Truths for the Noble Ones. The truths aren't noble. It's really the four, I like the word facts. Much better. Truth sounds a bit holy. Like all up there, you know. Facts. The four facts for the noble ones. And noble ones is a term of respect for those who realize this. What are the facts? These facts are about suffering. It's one way of framing, for the Buddha, it's one way of framing the entire path from A to Z. It's his first teaching. He gave in Sarnath. where we go on our pilgrimage. It's an advertisement for the pilgrimage we do since 2001 that benefits the prison project. It's probably raised $100,000, $500 a head. We've been doing it since 2001. I've done about 17 and I'm not bored yet. I think half of you guys have been on it, isn't it? Almost have a, you can have a pilgrimage club. But it really is an amazing experience to go to these places of the Buddha. We start in Kathmandu, we go to India, Lumbini, where he was born, Srivasti, where he spent 25 years of retreats with his disciples, the Buddha. Then we go to Kushinagar, where he passed away. We go to Rajgir, where he taught the Heart Sutra. Then we go to Bodh Gaya, where he got enlightened. And then we go, we end up at the end, where he first taught. And it's an amazing experience going through India. Everybody, almost everybody in every group since 2001 adores it. It's a very special experience. I recommend you go before you die. That's my advertisement. October. Postcards out there. We've still got postcards? Good. Okay, I hope so. Okay. Okay, so Sarnath, Lord Buddha taught this one in Sarnath, his first teaching. And like the point is here, to there's various ways of framing Buddha's teachings, this course, this package. One is it's a path of stopping ignorance and getting wisdom. One is it's a method of stopping suffering and getting happiness. And one is it's a method of ethics. They all come to the same thing. This is very interesting. They all come to the same thing. And this is why I find the point interesting. For example, the word wisdom is kind of a bit weird for us. It sounds a bit, I don't know what. She's got lots of wisdom. We say like that. But often in our culture, when we think of people who got a lot of wisdom, a lot of intelligence, we think of the amazing scientists or the whoever, and that's true. But what's fascinating in our culture, you can be a genius, mathematician, but still go home and beat up your husband. No, we're still being neurotic. That's schizophrenic for the Buddha. The Buddha's view of getting rid of ignorance, it implies ethics. They're utterly integrated. It mightn't be evident immediately. When we practice it, you'll see. You cannot possibly have wisdom in the way Buddha talks that doesn't imply ethics. Because wisdom is what you get when you give up anger and neurosis and all the rubbish that causes us to harm others. So you bring your own happiness, you bring your own wisdom by practicing ethics. They all come together. It's very interesting. So, okay. The essence of, so the four noble, the four truths, the four facts for the noble ones. One, there is suffering. Two, there are causes. Three, you can get rid of it. Four, how to do it. Down on the earth, it's like that. It's presented in great depth and often extremely confusing because it is so, it can be so intense and subtle and nuanced. But let's get the essence always, the essence of it. The essence of it. So what is, there is suffering. We all know that word, but everybody in the room will have a different definition, I promise. What's Buddha's? Well, there are three levels of it. One way of presenting. Three levels of suffering. The grossest, most evident, and we all agree upon this one, is when the bad things happen. Pretty simple. We call, even, you know, there's a mildest level of suffering when your husband is mean to you in the morning, or when he doesn't put the toilet seat down or something. You know, you get annoyed and irritated. That's a label for suffering, unhappiness. Then to the worst, most intense, we've been abused or harmed, brutalized, whatever. There's a spectrum. We all can see that. And that's just on this planet. We're not going to even talk about other realms of existence. We can mention that out of interest. We will deal with that when we talk about the mind. But even just think of a human realm. And this, in terms of the four kinds of karma, is called the experiences similar to the cause, which means the experiences in this life of when bad things happen to us, which are caused by our doing things like that in the past. We are the cause. That's when you get to the second noble truth, the second one. We're just saying it here. So that's what we know is suffering. Everybody, and monkeys and dogs and ants agree. You watch their behavior. It's instinctive and primordial in all sentient beings, which implies our craving not to suffer and our craving to be happy. So Buddha takes that as, great babies, I've got a method for you. Here it is. So the first kind of suffering. So this is where, if you want to look at the, so the first kind of suffering, and then you go, well, what are the causes? Which is the second fact. Well, the causes, you know, so we get it so complex in our psychology. We've got to get back to the past, looking for needles in haystacks, look at our genes, our DNA, our this, and mummy's behavior, daddy's behavior, grandma's behavior, uncle's behavior. We search all of that to get a picture of what this person is. Buddha's is way, way, way more direct and way more simple. I tell you. There are two causes of suffering as far as the Buddha is concerned. Also, to make us, just in case we get unhappy, there are also two causes of happiness, the same logic. Past action, my past action, karma, that is the thing I did with, so in terms of happiness, let's say, a person is generous to me. A person gives me some money, I need the money for a taxi, here, Ben, I have mine. That's a moment of happiness, and, you know, and the main causes. Now, we think, why are you happy, Rabina? Oh, Mary gave me $20. So we say Mary is the main cause of my happiness. Hear my point. Very simple. Equally for the suffering. Why are you suffering, Rabina? Because Mary took my $20. So as far as we're concerned, there's one cause of suffering, even though our psychology makes it more nuanced. And that's the person who did it to me. So if you think about it, we blame Mary for our happiness in just the same way as we blame Mary for our suffering. We assume the main causes are out there. And this is a scientific point. Our models of the mind and neuroscience and everything says that. And we believe that. That's our instinctive view. That's the view of ego grasping. Buddha doesn't disagree that that plays a role, but as far as Buddha's concerned, Mary is merely a catalyst. This is very shocking to us, and this takes the longest time. And this is back to karma as well, junior school. The main cause of my suffering, there are two, and they're both inside me. Because why does Buddha present this? Because if they're inside, you know, if he gives me the reason for my suffering as Mary, then why is he telling me he has to talk to Mary? She can do the job, which we think she should. No, Buddha's talking to me. Hey, babe, Rabina, there are two causes, honey. One is your past action, action meaning karma, starting with the intention to take the $20, take money from her, speaking simplistically. It was an action similar to the result based upon a delusion. Karma and delusion, two causes of suffering. That's it. My past action, based on a delusion. Happiness, two causes. My past action of generosity, based upon a virtue. That's it. That's it. That's the analysis. We have to unpack that. And the point is, then, this is advice for me, not Mary. And why this is so hard, even though the advice is so simple, is only because we're addicted to the opposite. That's all. Buddha says we've been believing the opposite for countless lifetimes. It's embedded in our being. We believe it utterly. So it's immensely hard. It's like reversing the energy of a bomb to internalize this view. Because these two pieces of advice, therefore, I see, that's the cause, is it? So like you go to your doctor, what's the cause? Eating sugar. Well, what's the solution? Stop eating sugar. Boom, done. Not sue the sugar company. You could do that. People do that. They sue Marlboro while they continue to smoke, you know. You could do that, but that won't help your sugar. It won't help your diabetes, suing them. So you could blame Mary and put her in prison. It won't help you be any happier. But you work on you. Buddha says, we're the boss. So if I want happiness, practice generosity. If I want happiness, be kind. If I want happiness, don't steal. It's really simple. It's embarrassing. If we can get it all out of the way of our own dramas, you know, that resist and kick and scream and shout. So two causes of my suffering, second noble truth. My actions, which is karma, which we dealt with in junior school, and then my delusion. That's the main one. And now we get into that one. Now we start describing this one. And this is the first kind of suffering. Now let's go to the second kind of suffering. So okay, before we go there, the first kind of suffering. Oh gosh, I got harmed. Oh gosh, Mary hurt me. I wonder what the cause is. Let's look up Buddha's thing. Like you go to the, I remember in the health stops, they're lovely, the homeopathic companies are great. They have this little kind of list of sicknesses from A to Z. So you got, there's arthritis, what's the solution? And you go through the bottles, A to Z. Oh, there's the medicine. Thank you very much, bye. Same here. You look up the four facts. Mary just took my $20. That's not fair. It's called suffering. The first kind of suffering. I don't like that. What's the cause? Oh, my past stealing based upon greed. That's interesting. What's the solution? Stop stealing and stop greed. Thank you. Bye. Done. That's it. I mean, that's it. We just don't like it so simple. So in other words, to stop the first kind of suffering, You stop doing actions like that to others. That's why the first level of practice is don't kill, don't steal, don't jump on the wrong partner, don't this, don't that, don't this. Seven little things, seven little baby actions of body and speech. And the last three are where we begin to work on the mind. I haven't mentioned, but that's the three delusions. We'll get to those now. That's the advice. That's why he says don't kill, don't steal. Not because he says so. Not because he's going to punish you. There's no concept like that. It's advice of a doctor. Because you know what, Rabina, sweetie pie? Those things will happen to you if you keep doing them. And that's it. It's a very simple solution. Like if you keep eating sugar, you get diabetes. So stop doing it right now. And put an atomic bomb on the actions you've done in the past before they ripen as you're suffering. That's the method. That's junior school. Now we get to the deeper level. We get to the root of why your body and speech did those things, because they're your servants. You get to the mind. Buddha's expertise. The mind. I love Buddha's view of the mind. I know I'm prejudiced. I'm sorry. But all I can do is tell you what I like, and it's up to you to like it if you want, and give you a bit of logic. 11:20. Okay, we'll keep going a bit longer. Yeah, because we'll just run out of time. So I've got to tell you about the mind. Then we'll have questions before we stop. Okay, like we talked yesterday, what's the mind to the Buddha? Not physical, has far more subtle levels of cognition, has this astonishing, insane potential to be free of all rubbish and full of all the goodness, and didn't begin in your mother's womb, and is not the handiwork of mummy, daddy, or a creator. That it's a beginningless continuity of mental moments and an endless continuity of mental moments. And that everything you think and do and say is programmed in it. That's it. That's your mind. Not physical, all those things. So yeah, we have to take that on board and think about it, because it ain't our definition. That's clear. Of the neuroscientists. But that's why it's so marvellous they're all talking now. And the Dalai Lama and his mob have been having these conversations with the neuroscientists for 30, 40 years. And now this Indian stuff, this Buddha stuff has begun to be kind of taken seriously by these modern scientists, which is fantastic, you know, amazing, so marvellous. And that's the kindness and the humility of His Holiness, you know. Incredible. So, okay, here, when we start to look into the causes of suffering, that means we have to understand very specifically the category of states of mind called delusions. Well, we know that the usual word, if you read His Holiness and all the classic literature, the typical word that's translated into English, which comes from the Tibetan, which comes from the Sanskrit word klesha, and it translates as afflictions. Now, we can get used to that word, it's true, but we know in our world it's kind of old-fashioned. We don't in normal life talk about I've got an affliction, which is not the word we use. It's in the English dictionary, it's okay. We don't use it. So for that, as soon as we use a word we don't use, and we sort of make it special, like an affliction is something different. But it's like a problem, suffering, illness. These are words for affliction. So what kind of affliction are these that a Buddha talking about? Not physical ones. He's talking about mental afflictions. He's talking about afflictions in our mind. So for me, one of the best translations of the word klesha is mental illness. Now this is very shocking to us, because that's way over the end of the spectrum, down there, those people over there. Not me. But all Buddha's saying, and this is really a good way to put it, we are all mentally ill to the extent that we have any attachment, any fears, any anger, any jealousy, any anxiety, any panic attacks. It's just a question of degree, and that's a literal truth for the Buddha. So it's a very different view. We tend to think I'm normal. But when you have attachment and want to jump on 14 girls a day, then you become like mentally ill. You got to, even that we wouldn't call a mental illness. We'd say it's addiction. Well, that's a mental illness. But they're all mental illnesses. And this is when you get used to thinking this way, it becomes very powerful to understand. So this is why we have to look at the bigger picture of Buddha's view of the mind. It's deceptively simple, but it's very clear. First of all, this is very telling, and we're going to get to emptiness today. I promise, and I will. So two, when you study the Buddhist model of the mind, and I'm sure you've studied it here, Lohrig, haven't you? Donna?
Yes.
We should study it more. Go more deep into it. Not just learn the words and then cross your fingers. Because every word I'm saying here is from this model, okay? I'm not making it up, I promise. So you study the epistemological model of the mind and you study the psychological model of the mind. So let's look quickly at the epistemological, because already this is so tasty and really implies something very powerful, and you will see. And I've said and done this every time I come, so it's not new. Okay. So epistemological model is the way the mind functions. And this is incredibly detailed in Buddhist psychology. And it's so complex and utterly fascinating. And we're not talking about the brain. We're talking about the actual cognitive process itself. It's utterly fascinating. And where does this knowledge come from? The holy beings from the Buddha onwards who have looked inside and unpacked and unraveled the contents. This is the job we have to do. And this, we do not talk like this in our culture. So, the epistemological model is the mind functions at the level of the sensory consciousness, and then the mind functions at the level of mental consciousness. So mental is the point. As Lama Zopa puts it, that's where the workshop is. And all Tibetans always point here. But let's look for a second, simply speaking, at the way the sensory consciousness works. And why we should is because, as Lama Yeshe says, we make the body the boss. We live our lives even believing I am only the body. And so whatever the body tells us, we think that's the truth. So we define our happiness and suffering in terms of our body. One day you have a slight knee ache, you call that unhappiness. So we are so driven by the feelings through our senses, but we give enormous inappropriate power to the senses, the Buddhist view would say, and this is really intense. So let me give you a simple example. You know, my simple example, every time, I haven't changed it for years, or maybe get too boring, I'll change it. You see me pick up this cup and you see my face go here, you see my eyes are open, and I will say out of my mouth, what a pretty cup. So we will all deduce, won't we, that my eyes see a pretty cup. Well, no. Thinking simply, no. What's happening here is so amazing, so speedy, so complex, but it all happens in a millisecond, and we inappropriately give all the power to the eyes. Well, as far as the Buddhist view is concerned, when you start to learn the way the sensory consciousness functions, sensory consciousness, consciousness is another word for the mind. Mind is not physical. So sensory consciousness is that part of our mind that functions through the medium of the eyeball, the medium of all the nerves all working, my eyelid open and the lights on, all the bits and pieces all coming together. And I will have a cognition called an eye consciousness. And what eye consciousness can cognize is precisely two things, shape and color. Now, obviously makes us ask the question, what part of my mind cognizes a pretty cup? Well, it ain't your eyes, baby. It's your mental consciousness. But, you know, what's happening is this, and it's so brilliant. Quicker than Google, and this is honestly true, quicker than Google, what happens is the millisecond my eyes meet this, because I've been programmed with this all my life, I've stored in my mind all my memories. One Lama said, or Lama Zopa said, it's like we're taking photos all day. One way the mind works is we've got this camera here, and it just takes photos all day, and they're all stored as memories. That's another way, not karma, different one, very powerful. There's nothing we've ever experienced since beginning this time that's not stored in our mind. That's why we can get clairvoyance. Access a subtle level, we can have clairvoyance. That's why. And remember the past, see the future. So all this is stored in my mind, just even in this life. So instantly, because I've worked out what I like, and there's a dragon, there's blue, and the shape, and I see it, and the thing, and the this, and I, because I've got my own flavor, my own taste over my life, what I think is pretty. So quicker than Google, based on all that, millions of things happening so quickly, out comes this opinion, a viewpoint, a concept. What a pretty cup. It's an opinion. It's a conceptual thought. Now this gets us to the way the mind works now. Mental consciousness works. This is the point. So that's where the workshop is. So then we look into the way that consciousness works. There are two ways. Only two. Mental consciousness. We have conception and we have perception. That's it. So we've got to understand what Buddha means by that. We use perception in a normal way, and that's perfectly fine. But in Buddhist psychology, that's a really precise definition. Conception is, we'll get to that in a second, but conception is the level we live at. So we would say conception, and then we'd say feelings. And whoever it was on the very first day talked about our emotions, human emotions. Who was that? Are you still here? Who said those words to me? Human emotions. This is now finally answering your point. But you're not here. It took me 4 days, but 5 days, and we're now here. But you're not here. Unless you forgot. So we'll talk about it. So we talk about, we give this massive discussion about our human emotions. And they are human emotions. But that's, we give a huge power to all these feelings and emotions. But the Buddha view is, from here to here, it's all opinions, viewpoints. And some of those opinions are dressed with lots of emotion. And that's when the body is involved. Whew. So a viewpoint is what a pretty cup, wherever it's gone. What happened to my pretty cup? It's disappeared. So my pretty cup, you know, is I'm not sort of hysterically grasping my pretty cup, and I'm going to the therapist because I've got a crack in it, which we might do if we're seriously attached to my pretty cup. We understand that, but all of it comes. There's my pretty cup. So all of these are conceptual stories. This is very shocking to hear, and let's prove it. Look at a person who's angry, out of their brain with rage, going mad. You understand? You see them screaming, shouting, tears, irrational words vomiting out the mouth, flailing, kicking, punching. Think about it. Now you get your MP3 player or your iPhone and you record their words. I say this all the time, but it's powerful. It proves the point. You record what they say and you type it accurately with all the hysterical things, all the exclamation marks, all the irrational sentences, exactly what they say, and you have it on a piece of paper. Anybody with half a brain, when they read those words and see the exclamation marks, you'll go, wow, this person's angry. Won't you? And what are you seeing? You're not hearing any shouting. You're seeing thoughts written on a piece of paper. What are words? They're expressions of thoughts. That's what words are. So every word that comes out of our mouth is a conceptual, it's a viewpoint, it's a thought, a viewpoint, a concept. This has a huge meaning in Buddhism. Because that's the gross level of cognition of our mental consciousness. It's the grossest of the gross. It's all we posit in our culture. But this Buddha's view, when you've got your single point of concentration, like we read yesterday from Lama Yeshe, when you've got your shamatha, when you've got this amazing, when you've accessed this more subtle level of your consciousness, when you've completely subdued the sensory and the conceptual, which are the grosser level and the level at which we suffer, which we have to sort out, which we're going to talk about, which we are talking about, you've accessed a subtler level, and then you get to a level of non-conceptuality. We don't talk like this. It's powerful meaning, because our mind, when it's at a subtler level, has what they call direct perception, non-conception of something. It's abstract to us. Of course it is. But it's a subtle level of our mind. So virtually in our lives, we never touch that level. We live at the level of opinions. We live at the level of concepts. Our mind has got a million concepts a second. We're driven by concepts. And we divide some into intellectual, mathematical concepts, musical concepts. What do you think a person studying Bach is doing? So many concepts they fill their head with. Then they play it on a piano. I mean, musical theory is just phenomenal, unbelievably elaborate presentation of extraordinary conceptual ideas. Think about it in the head first. Then it turns into music on a piano, and then it makes out lovely sounds. But you look at the stuff that you're learning, the concepts. Look at mathematics. Unbelievable, rigorous, disciplined concepts. Everything starts with concepts. Everything starts with concepts. 1 + 1 = 2 is a concept. I hate you, you're ugly, is a concept. But one's got emotion around it, and one's up here, which is called intellectual. We make this bizarre difference. Buddha says it's just all a question of levels, concepts, and then he divides all these conceptual stories, all these mental levels, the level of our mental consciousness at the level of concepts, into three categories. There's no fourth. First are the neurotic, ridiculous, delusional, mistaken, wrong, Lama Yeshe has 21 synonyms for them in here that he made up to get us to understand what the hell a klesha is. Oh, it's an affliction. They're all the neurotic, deluded ones. And they are the source of all of our suffering. And Buddha has found from his own experience that they're not at the core of our being. They're adventitious. They're made up. They're bells and whistles that we have added. We don't need them. That's why he comes to the conclusion we can rid the mind of them, which is sangye, sang, the first one. That's the first lot of misconceptions, wrong views, delusions, neurotic emotions, disturbing emotions, afflictions. They're all synonymous. Now, some of these, and they're mainly dealt with in the day-to-day life, like attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, they're the emotional ones. But there are other wrong views, as Buddha calls, and they're philosophical viewpoints that he argues with. He's not being kind of a sectarian. So we have a view that my mother created me. Buddha says, no, misconception. We have a view that a creator created me. No, he says, misconception. He's not being rude. He doesn't want to start a war. He's telling you what he has seen. Misconception. It gives his logic. Anger, a wrong view, plus an emotion. But they're all equal in being misconceptions. And our mind is riddled with layers and layers and layers and layers and layers and layers. And they're all embedded there for eons, and they're our truth. So when I say, what a pretty cup, I'm not saying, well, you know, from my point of view, it's quite a pretty cup. What do you think, Jason? No, I'm saying that's the truth. When I say you're ugly, I'm saying that's the truth. And that's the killer. As Lama Zopa puts it, bad enough that we see things, in my words now, through the lenses of our own neuroses. Bad enough that we see things wrongly. But the worst thing is we believe it's true. That's what keeps us paralyzed in samsara. That's the nightmare. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
This is Buddha's view, babies. In my Australian words. Okay. So we need to know our minds intimately, deeply, amazingly. And once we start that job, that itself begins to make us happy, because we can't wait to get to the next level of the junk, because we know we can fix it. But now we think, I got born this way, I don't know why I got this, I don't know where it comes from, and it scares the life out of us. So we do everything in our power either to blame somebody else or to bury it deep, because we can't cope. That's why we go crazy. But when we have this view, knowing it's your stuff, just a bunch of ridiculous old habits, they're all just a bunch of conceptions, we've got to use wisdom and clarity to unpack and unravel them and argue with them, to deconstruct them and make them fly into space and disappear like a puff of smoke. That's our job, to be our own therapist. Are we communicating? That's the first level, the neurotic ones. The second level are the love and compassion and kindness and wisdom and all the other stuff. Now, they are not neurotic. They are not misconceptions to some degree. Until you realize emptiness is some misconception there. They're not misconceptions. They are in sync with reality, and they are the source of happiness. The other stuff is why we suffer. The second lot are why we get happy. And the third lot are like the mechanics of the mind. I like to call it that. They normally call them negative, positive, neutral. But neutral sounds like they don't matter. No. They're neither negative in their characteristic of being ridiculous conceptions made up, nor are they virtuous ones. They are like, I like to call them the mechanics of the mind. And these we all know. Intention, attention, concentration, good memory. You know, many, many of these listed. And we have to become intimately familiar with these. And these are trained brilliantly in single point of concentration. They're the bits and pieces that make us do anything well. Without these, we're demented. They're the ones that make order in our mind. So in other words, one of these is, this is a really good one, one of these is called mindfulness. So of course there's 57 varieties of that in our culture, and that's fine, Buddha doesn't own the word, but if we understand exactly Buddha's definition, mindfulness is literally the ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. So when you're making a cake, if you start to do the eggs and you forget and you put the sugar in, you don't have mindfulness. You haven't got a good memory. They even translate it sometimes, Lama would, as memory, which makes us think it's about past memory, a little pot that you look into about your memories. We all talk about that in the West. You go on a holiday so you can store your memories. It's a bizarre idea. No, it's the ability to not lose the plot of what you're doing moment by moment. So when I said in one course, and I quoted Lama Zopa, thieves need mindfulness. Some man who was very offended, he thought I was insulting Vipassana meditation. No, just quoting the meaning of mindfulness. It's the ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. And that's one of the states of mind we must develop in what's called concentration meditation. But there's these different parts. You've got attention, intention, concentration, good memory, there's alertness. There's many of these. We just say these words now, they're empty words. But we need to learn to identify these and hone these and develop them. That's when we become a brilliant scientist or a brilliant piano player or a brilliant meditator. These are like the mechanics of the mind. There's no fourth category, okay? So we have to learn to unpack it and know these. So Buddha has identified 84,000 distinct mental illnesses. And Ling Rinpoche recently said there are 21,000... He said all of these subsume into, I can't think of the preposition that's right, subsume to the three poisons. Luckily, he gets from 84,000 down to three. A great relief. And if we can get these three, we're really on a roll with knowing Buddhist psychology and knowing yourself, I tell you. So, you know, three poisons, he calls them, well, I think, three toxic emotions. Great modern term. And so we're going to go into these now. These are the point now. I'm getting to the point now. This is where we're going. So the first one, and there's a hierarchical relationship between these three, a direct relationship between these three. In our culture, we use these words, but there's kind of random moments of different things. There's no relationship. We don't think like this. But this is Buddha's analysis. The root one, as they call it, the root mental illness, the root affliction, the root delusion, is called, literally, ignorance. But, of course, like all these things, it's got a specific definition. It's specifically the ignorance of how things actually exist or ultimately exist. Ignorance of how things act, the I and everything else, how they actually exist. What happened to Jack, Jim? Where are you going? You need the wall. Oh God, I understand very well. So this ignorance is Mat Rigpa in Tibetan, but colloquially known as ego grasping. What a delicious title. But this is the deepest, most primordial, the hardest to see and the hardest to get rid of, and the one such that when we do, when you've got your first moment of realizing that what that ignorance thinks is true isn't, that's your first moment of realizing emptiness. That's your first moment of climbing out of samsara into your nirvana, and now you become labeled a superior being. You've got more work to do, baby, but you can't go back after that, and that we have never done. The Buddha says we've been high rebirths. We've had realizations. We could even have had bodhicitta. We've had a single point of concentration. We've lost it. We keep falling down the mountain. We haven't got to the peak. Once you quote-unquote realize emptiness with direct perception in your mind, beyond conceptuality, beyond sensory, this naked microscope of your mind, seeing the reality that the I that we thought was there has never been, isn't, and never could be. That's your first moment of the beginning of your liberation. That's the realization of emptiness, which we'll go into. That root delusion is the mother of them all. Ego grasping, great term. And it's necessary, this is what's interesting, people often say, where's fear in the list of delusions in Buddhism? Well, fear is the flavor of all of them, and primordial and especially the root delusion. Mostly it's like a sleeping lion, and it's a bit like Mr. Darwin's instinct for survival. I think Buddha would have liked that phrase. That's ego grasping. You're sitting there merrily driving and a car suddenly nearly hits you. Absolute panic comes, doesn't it? That's ego grasping waking up. That's what Buddha Darwin calls instinct for survival. No, it's just called ignorance, and it's ridiculous. So when you got rid of that, you have got rid of fear. This is insane for us, you know. That wonderful story about Lama Zopa, up in the mountains. He's said to be the reincarnation of the Laodo Lama. Laodo, there's another advertisement, another postcard out there. The last 3 years we've been going up to Laodo, a trek, 15 days. We walk for a couple of days at Kopan, walk 4 days up, get up to the, and then when we go up to Laodo, 4,500 meters, how many feet that is, I don't know, 14,000 feet. Then we start there for 6 days, Lama Zopa's cave from his past life. And what it was a hole in the wall, and the Laodo Lama in the past life, Kunsang Yeshi, before Lama Zopa, was this layman, a secret practitioner, a great yogi, who spent the last years of his life, he saw this little hole in the wall where they used to store the radishes. So he pulled out the radishes and moved in. And that became his cave, so he's known as the Radish Lama. That's Lama Zopa. I think radishes or onions, I always forget which one. The Laodo Lama. So there's a little spot up on the hill above Mende, above Namche, and we walk up there. And we've done that 3 years. We're doing another one next year. So the postcard says May, it's a mistake. It'll be October. You'll see that on the website. And that's to raise money for Lama Zopa's amazing vision to build a replica of Guru Rinpoche's Pure Land up there above the cave. It's a wonderful idea. It's an amazing place. So special. And it's hard work. If you like mountains, you'll love it. And it's got very thin air, so you've got to get used to it. But it's great. And that raises money for Rinpoche's project. So that's my other advertisement. So meanwhile, when he was a little boy, his sister, I'm doing Lama Zopa's biography, meant to be, I haven't looked at it much, but I interviewed his sister, who's 6 years older than Rinpoche. She's been taking care of this place the last, 50 years. She's unbelievable. At 78, still walks up and down the mountains, and knees are gone, digging the potatoes, you know, she's unbelievable, unbelievable. Anyway, she said when he was born, he was always different. They lived a really simple life, you know, in one room. They would always sit over there on a box. He'd always eat on his own, like a llama would, you know. He's just like a little llama, you know. And then he played all his games. He made his mud pie dorgies and his mud pie bells and his mud pie tormas. And he would announce that his benefactors were coming. And he'd say all the names of his past life benefactors. Every time Mummy turned her back, little Zopa is crawling up the hill, up this track that they know leads to the Laodo cave of the previous Lama who died. And he'd always stopped at a place called the resting place. They'd find him there curled up asleep. They'd drag him home, you know. And every time when he could talk, it was the same. He'd be walking up the hill to go to the Laodo cave. And Mummy would say, come home. He'd say, no, that is my home. So little children, girls and boys, as many girls being recognized these days, Western girls and others, reincarnated lamas, you know. So the memory is very fresh when they're young. And of course, if he is at the reincarnation, he's chosen his rebirth. That's very clear. So anyway, Mummy thought she'd better check with the local lama. So they do their divinations, and they said, yes, it seems he is the reincarnation of the Laodo Lama. So anyway, then he was sent off to the monastery. So there's one monastery way up high, Rowaling, someplace up, couple of thousand feet more up, or whatever. And he was up there, and this is how he told this story. He was about 8. He tells it differently every time, but it's in all the transcripts. So roughly speaking, he's up in the mountain, up here in the monastery, and there's this big river. And on the other side of the river, these very strange-looking people with straw-coloured hair and pale eyes. Sounds like zombies, you know. They were white people. He'd never seen white people. So he wanted to meet them. So you don't go empty-handed. So he went over this rickety bridge with his bowl of potatoes, but he fell in the river. And they're very fast-flowing rivers. And, of course, they don't teach him swimming up there. So this is how he told the story. It was beautiful. He said he noticed the head. The head came to the surface for air. And he saw his manager have a panic attack running on the bank, you know. And then he said, the thought occurred to me that the person known as the Laodo Lama is about to die. And then he said, I didn't know anything about emptiness, which meant in that life he'd never heard it. But there was no fear. Now that's the way he spoke that is exactly the description, the indication of the way a person has realized emptiness would talk. So that means when he said even the head, one practice we need to learn to do, I keep saying we're going to get into all this, but I keep getting into all of it as I'm speaking. You know, we say, my head, I'm about to drown. So, because we grasp, and we're going to, this grasp at this inherent I, grasping at an I that Buddha says that isn't there. There is an I here, but not what we think. We over-exaggerate it. We distort it. We make it massive, like Mount Everest. And the grasping of that is this fear. When it's awakened, panic arises. So, of course, Mr. Darwin assumes everybody must have it. That's what makes you do this and that. Buddha says, don't be silly. This makes you go crazy. You need intelligence to know what to do, not fear. So, he didn't have that. He'd removed the ego grasping from his mind. There was no belief in his mind of an inherent me. Therefore, he was observing very clearly that what was happening. That a person known as a Lado Lama, me, is about to drown. But he said there was no fear. And that, see, that's the thing. We think, well, if there's no fear, he must kind of sink to the bottom of the river like a stone and go, oh, well, I'm drowning. What the hell? No, that's nihilism. He still is not stupid. He goes up for air. But his mind is clear. So if you can conceive of that, then you'll begin to understand. So he's drowning, but his mind is clear. So his mind would be clear because he's rid of ego grasping, which means then, secondly, he's rid of attachment, which is the main voice of ego grasping, which we're now going to describe. And then on the basis of that, he's also rid of anxiety and panic and aversion and anger and rage and despair and depression, because that's the consequence of attachment. So these three toxic emotions have this intimate relationship. So he's rid of the ego grasping, therefore there's no fear, therefore there's no attachment, therefore there's no anger, therefore there's no other, 84,000, all gone. So he's observing it. So he did what he could to get up there, and he somehow got saved. But he was completely clear, as if he'd been walking along the street undisturbed. His mind couldn't be disturbed. When you rid the mind of delusions, you cannot be disturbed. You cannot be angry. You cannot be attached. You cannot be anxious. The stuff that we believe is at the core of our being. This is Buddha's insane view, which is so delicious. Are we communicating? Good. Too late for tea break because lunch is in 30 minutes. So I think we should have, before I go into more detail, no, I have to go into more detail, I'm very sorry, I have to. Then we can ask a few questions before we go to lunch, okay? Are we okay so far?
Yeah.
We're communicating?
Yeah.
All right, good. Recognizing inside here what I'm saying? I mean, you say, oh yeah, I get that one, I see that one. Okay, so these three toxic emotions are the summary, the essence of the 84,000. And as Ling Rinpoche said in Leeds when I was in England recently, 21,000 of these are related to attachment, 21,000 related to anger, 21,000 related to ego grasping, and 21,000 that are related to all of them. So this massive picture of Buddha's discovery of the mind divided into 84,000 different delusions, and they all subsume into the three, and they all come down to the root. And when the root is there, the others crumble into a state of nothingness. This is the way Buddha talks, in my words. So we have to learn to know our mind. So first you control your body and speech, the servants of your mind. Then you can now begin to work on the mind. And you don't go out of ignorance first. You start at the grossest one, anger. Then you go to attachment. But we look at attachment and anger now, because these are the essence of today. Attachment, in fact, is the source of our daily suffering, essentially. Ego grasping is the source of all of it. But effectively in our daily life, in this realm of desire, as Buddha calls it, which is a realm created by us karmically, like karmic evolution, created by attachment over lifetimes after lifetimes after lifetimes. Who do you think has created these bodies with breasts and things that go into things and eyes that look and things that... I mean, hear my point without being too gross. We karmically, our karmic evolution over many eons of time, have created our attachments, has created this body of desire, driven by desire, feeding through the five senses. This is what Buddha means by samsara. We created it. We made ourselves over countless lifetimes of habit. So we have to understand attachment. And if we can understand attachment, we can understand Buddhism. I promise. So what is attachment? It's the main voice of ego grasping. And what's ego grasping? Speaking just colloquially, this ego grasping or ignorance, it's the main delusion. At the root of it, which sounds so abstract, it's what causes us to be separate from others. This is so bizarre to us. And so this sense of being a separate me, which is empty and nothing and nobody and fear-based and panic and it's like nothing me. This is the irony of ego grasping, self-pity me, as Lama Yeshe calls it. And it's all just there, latent, driving the others. So it gives rise naturally to the main voice. Given that I think I'm nothing, then attachment is the voice of dissatisfaction. I never have enough. I don't have enough. What I have is not enough. What I accomplish is not enough. What I get is not enough. My shape of my body is not enough. My beauty is not enough. My hair is not the right thing. Everything I have is never enough. It's the default mode of the half a glass full, empty. That's the disease of the habit of attachment over many lifetimes. The most primordial energetic level of attachment. Never enough. So of course if you think you've got never enough, what are you going to do? You're hankering after something. Naturally. And what do we hanker after? The objects of the senses. The world out there. What else? So attachment then, like a maniac, because junkiness, hankering. And there must be something out there such that when I have contact with it, happiness is triggered. That's attachment's job. Attachment's job is to find things, people, events, sounds, smells, tastes, words, whatever, such that when I get contact with it, it will somehow fill up the gaping hole. This is what drives us. It drives all sentient beings. It's primordial, automatic. So to summarize it, which sounds very brutal, and I haven't finished its job yet, the next part, function of attachment, is that then when it gets the object, it grotesquely exaggerates its deliciousness and its power to make me happy. So which sets up massive expectation and then massive manipulating and controlling to get it and then possession of it. And all of that is a lie. It's a lie we've made up. And so when the bubble bursts, it's the devastation of disappointment, aversion, panic, anxiety, anger, and then aggression, despair, and depression. That's the third toxic emotion. That's samsara. So when we open it up like that, we understand, we recognize. And then all the other delusions like, you know, pride, low self-esteem, all the other bits and pieces, forget 87,000, 84,000, just a few, we get, they're all coming as a result of these. So we have to know, we have to look inside, know the theories first, and then recognize, and then begin to unpack and unravel, and argue with, because they're not valid conceptions. They're not valid conceptions. They're made up stories that we've believed in for eons. This is how Buddha talks about the mind. It's the hardest job we'll ever do, but when we do it, this is what causes happiness. This is Buddha's method for stopping suffering and getting happiness. Control your body, control your speech, and change your mind. That's it. All the way to Buddhahood. Ask me some questions. That's just a summary. I'm going to do more deep later. Go more deep into attachment, more deep into aversion, more deep into these relationships. But ask me some questions now, if you'd like, about anything I've said so far.
So the goal is to not have attachment by realizing that our sense of uncomfortableness or not feeling enough, the solution isn't outside. The solution is within. If we're not to grasp for things outside of us, money, food, whatever, possessions, materialism, where do we look and how do we satisfy that?
So there's a question, please.
How do we satisfy that?
What?
How do we satisfy that?
Satisfy what?
So we have this.
What's the question? Make it a question, not a statement. It really helps the mind.
Where do we look? What do we do to satisfy that sense?
To satisfy what?
That sense of emptiness, of not being good enough.
But getting rid of attachment. What do you think? I'm just saying it.
So
that's the answer.
How do we get rid of attachment?
Well, that's the whole damn path. I'm trying to tell it to you.
Okay.
You mean how long have you been studying it?
So, stop. I haven't been studying it formally. I've been coming for probably 2 or 3 years.
Okay, but you're listening to all the teachings.
Yes.
So every one of those words you've been hearing is the method.
Okay.
So this is not being rude, but it shows how it takes time.
Okay.
Every word you've been hearing from Geshe-la, every word you've heard in Discovering Buddhism, every word you've heard, you've been hearing recipes the whole time.
Okay.
So it's hard to hear how to apply it, isn't it? But all the methods are there.
Okay.
So the first level of practice, control your speech.
Right.
Control your body.
Right.
practice ethics.
Uh-huh.
That's already practiced. That, okay. You get that surely.
Right.
Well, you're doing that?
I'm trying.
Well, you're are you doing that?
Yes.
Then you're practicing.
Okay.
You're practicing. So then you can see your mind. Do you ever notice your mind when you grasp at something?
Yes.
So what do you do with it? What do you try to do with it?
I try to, if I'm being greedy, I try to be generous.
Yeah, well then why are you asking me? You're just doing it. I'm really, really genuinely serious. You're asking me how to do it, but you're telling me just a simple answer. You're doing it. So why aren't you happy with that? That you're doing it. You are doing it. Don't you realize you're doing it?
I guess I did it.
Then, my God in heaven, what do you think you've been doing? Pretending? Not practicing? You've just proved the point, but you're not satisfied. Oh, somehow, it must be more than that I'm missing. What am I supposed to do? You're doing it, babe. No, I'm so serious. But you're proving the point that even that you're not satisfied with it, which
right.
is attachment.
Right.
So we're not attached. We're dissatisfied with a boyfriend, so we get another. We're dissatisfied with a cake, we get another. We're dissatisfied with our spiritual practice. So we've got to learn to realize you're doing the job. It's really very simple. You control your body, your speech, and your mind. You're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make it high. It goes to incredible levels of high, mm-hmm. but one little baby step at a time. So rejoice and delight and be happy that you're doing it. That's your next practice.
Just keep practicing.
No, your next practice is, say, my God in heaven or Buddha in heaven. I am actually practicing. This is amazing. That's what's missing.
Okay.
Because you're thinking you're not practicing. You're actually practicing, but you think you're not. That's the bizarre piece, but that's how we all are.
Okay.
So your practice that you're missing is, my goodness, I am practicing. I rejoice. So that's what you need to do.
Okay.
Do you hear my word?
Yes, ma'am.
What are you going to say to yourself?
I'm proud of myself for practicing.
And you really are practicing. You're doing your best.
Right.
As well as you can, step
right.
by step.
Right.
You should be blissed out and crying in happiness.
Okay.
But you've heard the methods and you're doing them.
Right.
Are you hearing me?
I am.
So you need to be satisfied that you're baby or grade one, wherever. Then that'll help you to keep moving. And you just keep moving from here to Buddhahood. One step at a time, listening to the instructions, listening, and every time, every time I say this stuff is my practice. Every time I say this stuff, I'm going to myself as I'm listening, wow, that's interesting. That's a good way of putting it, like someone else is saying it to me. I promise you. So you never end doing it, and you're always happy with it. You keep moving. Your understanding gets clearer, clearer, clearer. You're practicing. It's very shocking, your question, but everybody's like it. So thank you for asking it. But are you hearing how shocking it is that you should ask that question?
Yeah, I guess I'm just the clarity. I think as I gain clarity of my own actions and my own motives.
No, did you hear what I said?
I did.
What was your question?
My question is, what do I need to practice?
And then when we pointed out that you're doing it, you didn't realize. That's kind of weird, isn't it? But that's how we are, darling.
Yeah.
That means you're not satisfied.
Right.
That's attachment still running the show.
Yeah.
That's the irony. So we have to catch it like a hawk and tell it to go away.
Okay.
And put new words. I am doing well. That's practicing satisfaction.
Okay.
I'm doing well is practicing satisfaction. You look in the mirror, you see you've got the wrinkles and double chins. That's fine. I'm happy with that. That's satisfaction.
Okay.
You have your meal that's not so perfect and you go, you can fix it if you like. But also you can say, that's fine as it is. That's practicing satisfaction.
Okay.
So it's being realistic. On the earth, you are, you said it exactly, and you are practicing. Can we hear that, people? Where everyone is the same. Every one of you people in this room is doing what she's doing. You're practicing. According to your ability. We are lazy. We could do more. That's fine. That's not being dissatisfied. Just giving you energy. Do you understand? Okay. Other questions, please? Yeah.
My question corresponds with what you're saying today. We have a lot of Buddhist books at home, and I'm curious about which books correspond with the levels.
Exactly.
Junior school.
Exactly.
High school,
so just
college,
tell me some of your books.
Pardon?
Can you close all some of the titles? No.
We got a Lam Rim.
Good. Lam Rim is the whole one. Is the whole package.
So is that the...
That's A to Z. That's the whole package.
Okay, so is that the elementary school? That's the
whole package.
Whole deal.
That's the whole package. That's so, the whole course, from here to postgraduate, to all the way to the end.
So is that what we should start with and
that's the whole. It's good to read the whole package. And then any other book you find, you might find a book on the Heart Sutra. That's a specific piece on emptiness. You'll find a book about compassion, a particular practice of how to develop compassion. That's the university level. You'll find a particular one all about karma. That's junior school. So any other books, the big picture, you've got the big picture, the whole course from here to doctorhood. And then you've got pieces, then you've got different books that express different pieces of it. So when you know the big package, you'll get to know where the pieces fit. And that just takes time. And often it's hard for us, the way the Lamrim is presented is really literally 14th century, coming from Tsongkhapa in the 14th century. That's okay, but we've just got to really fix our minds to get around it so we can begin to express it in words that are 21st century, without losing the essence, and that's the hard part.
Is there a version of the Lamrim text? Because we have a few, and they're a little tough.
So tell me which ones you've got.
Oh, I don't know.
Have you got one by Yangtze Rinpoche? One's called, what's his book called? Yangtze Rinpoche. He speaks in English and he's taught. No, not that one. Not that one. No, Yangtze Rinpoche. It's a commentary he gave to Western people in English. So he taught to us.
So what's the name of the author?
The author, Yangtze. He's a Lama Center in Portland, and he taught it in English at Tushita in Dharamsala 25 years ago. A wisdom publisher. I can't think of the title, I've forgotten. But it is the whole path, and it's taught in a very gentle, nice way in words. It's still traditional, but it's in words that we can understand. And his name is Yangtze, Yangsi. Yangtze Rinpoche. She might be finding one for us. What have you got? There it is there. What's it called?
Practicing the Path.
Have you got that one?
No.
Okay, that's, let me have a look at it. Let me see. Okay, so yeah.
Yep.
It's still completely traditional, but it's taught in English to Western people. So
yeah, we were looking for something
thing.
More accessible.
Yeah, I'd say so. It's the whole thing. It's very traditional. But the main point, what's hard for us, is when we read the way they present it, because there's so much detail, it's like you can't see the, what do they say, can't see the forest for the trees. But it's only after you've done it again and again that you can be, I know for me, even editing. I mean, I worked on this book at Wisdom Publications when I was working there as an editor in my first few years of being a nun back in 1979. I edited, I mean, I forget now, it was all so long ago, I began it before, and then I left after it was published. But even though I was editing it, but I didn't know what I was talking about. I heard Lama Zopa first, I didn't know what he's talking about. I couldn't get the big picture. It takes a while because they present the details. And there's so many assumptions. That's fine. Learn it. Study it. But what I'm trying to do here is, when you realize the different the levels of it, the essence of junior school, which is all when you hear about impermanence and the lower realms and this and that, the essence is abide by the laws of karma. The essence of the next one we're talking here is work on the mind. The essence of the compassion wing is help others. The essence of postgraduate, that's where you put all together and practice the highest levels of core tantra. So really, it's easy if you hear it this way, but it took me a while to even be able to say these words. Do you understand? So when you know, any time you read about the mind, the analysis of what it is and how the mind works, that's middle scope or junior or middle or high school. Every time you hear about karma, impermanence, that's lower scope. That's junior school. Every time you hear about love, compassion, equanimity, the 37 paths of the bodhisattva, all of that's the compassion wing. So when you know that, even that helps a little bit. Do you understand? It just takes time.
Thank you.
Discovering Buddhism, the course you do here, is just a way that we presented years ago in the FPMT, another way of presenting in order all this stuff, but in a taught by Westerners. So it makes it a bit more accessible, you know. Do you understand? Yeah. 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 And these are all the full-on Lama Tsongkhapa, direct from the mouth, back from 14th century ones. And they're the source of all of the other books. And the one that Lama Zopa always quotes is liberation in the palm of your hand, which is completely traditional. Goes complete detail. All of these, you know? What are you doing? Leave it there.
I don't want them to fall.
No, they won't fall. It's a very small mountain. We can put it right up high. So what other questions? Yes, darling.
So first of all, I wanted to...
Into the mic.
Oh, first of all, I wanted to...
Right into
you.
The mic. Like an ice cream.
Okay, better?
Yeah.
First of all, I wanted to say thank you to you for being here and teaching us.
Awesome.
I'm having a wonderful time.
Good.
And so my question is, I would like to take the vows, but I'm afraid to take them because, for example, we have house plants, and once in a while you get these tiny animals like mites on it.
I understand that.
So, and to save your plants,
I understand,
you have to get rid of them.
I understand.
And yeah, so what are you going to do?
Ooh.
Without killing them, I mean, without harming them.
So we've got to get back to junior school for this. Okay, let's go on. Let's talk. It's a good point. So when we realize the big picture point of view in Buddhism, there's not an atom of space that's not pervaded by sentient beings. Our body is a walking zoo.
Yeah.
Our armpit is a zoo. It's an entire ecosystem in our mouth of real living beings who are in this realm right now that have been our mother in countless lives. I mean, so that's how the world is. You can't breathe without hurting sentient beings. I remember one time when I got into trouble on Facebook. When I put a picture of me, I always quote this story, I don't even know how to get into Facebook, Kate does it for me, but I put a picture of me in Liverpool years ago in England buying some kick-ass cheddar, because I love cheddar cheese, kick-ass cheddar, and all the fundamentalist vegans, the one who wanted to tell everybody what to do. How dare a Buddhist nun eat cheese, this kind of thing, you know? So I didn't want to be political or give lectures, but I've always wondered how many bugs get slaughtered on the road when we drive. So sure enough, you Google it, some dude has done the research, and this Dutch fellow, he's done the research on the number plate of one car per kilometre. It's like trillions on the number plate. So, honey, we can't survive. The biggest picture, we can't even exist without harming sentient beings, which is the tragedy of the suffering realm we exist in. It is in the nature of suffering. So given that, we've got to do what we can. That's all. You know, there's no point in just killing yourself. I mean, you just got to do what you can within that fact, become conscious. And then we can't not harm sentient beings, but we constantly do what we can. So Lamasopa, for example, he knows he's going to be driving in a van. He's got a big van. We bought his van years ago in San Francisco for the prison project. It's covered in mantras and sayings. It's hilarious. So he says, because when the bugs hit it, they get a blessing by even being touched by the Sanskrit mantra. Do you understand? You know, when you see even a bone or a dead ant, Lama Zopa said, even a bone that's 1,000 years old, that used to be the body of a sentient being, right? Well, that consciousness, wherever it is now, by saying mantra, which is powerful, which blesses your breath, you blow on it, the consciousness gets the benefit. So there's all these things we can do to benefit sentient beings. And then you become more conscious about not wanting to harm them. So you know you're going to meet a little mite, but there's many there that you can't see that you're already harming. So when you know this, you become conscious, you develop more compassion, you develop wish not to harm, you do your best. And then when you meet one, you do everything in your power not to harm it. All you can do is do that. That's one thing. But when you understand the power... Were you here yesterday about vows? Were you here yesterday? Were you here yesterday?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
When we talked about the power of vows. So I think you've got to hear this again, because we don't quite get it. The point is, as Lama Zopa says, and as the teachings say, it's only when we have the intention, I will, to do something, that you begin the process of creating karmic seeds in your mind. If there's no I, let me finish, and then you'll have questions. Then when you say, I will, and then the hands and the body then follow, and then you create karma, and the mind is programmed. So here we are sitting, consciously not consciously not killing anything, but we're creating zero karma of non-killing. So just to have enough delicious, intentional, non-killing seeds in your bank vault is what you need to simply get another human rebirth. So we need bucket loads of intentional non-killing karmic seeds, most important. They are the cause of even getting another human birth. Now, we don't have many of those, because here we are blessed by not seeing many sentient beings. Maybe you get a few mites when you grow your plants. But most of the time, we're not intentionally not killing. Do you get that point? Please, you've got to go one step at a time. Do you get that point? That this moment, there's no intention not to kill. You agree, because there's no sentient being there that you can see. But therefore, you're creating no virtue of non-killing. We have to have masses of intentional, virtuous, karmic seeds of non-killing, which can only come when you have the intention. Are you hearing me?
Yeah.
Are you hearing me? So we don't have many of those. And when we do have those, because our motivation of emptiness or our motivation of compassion are weak, that's not very strong virtue. Now, then we come to vows. Buddha's given us this powerful way to create virtuous karmic seeds 24 hours a day. So when you have a vow not to kill, but you sincerely want to keep every day, 24 hours a day, you're dropping rich, delicious, non-killing karmic seeds into your bank vault. In fact, just being a nice person is not enough. You've got to practice virtue in the context of keeping vows of morality. Because 24 hours a day, you are ticking over karmic seeds. Are you hearing this technically? Can you hear that?
Yes.
Can you hear that?
Yes.
Not only is it doing, vows have the power to do that, vows also purify at the depth of your mind the old tendencies to kill. So you don't be surprised if you live in vows every day, you're purifying your mind, you're creating billions of karmic seeds 24 hours a day, don't be surprised you will never meet a sentient being to kill because you're purifying killing. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So think of the benefits of doing it. And you'll be so happy to keep vows. You'll be so blissed out to have a vow. And then when you do meet a sentient being, you do everything in your power not to harm it. Are you communicating with me or not?
Yeah. But still, when I'm trying to get rid of these mites...
You didn't hear what I said.
Yeah.
You just didn't hear what I said. Oh. I said you do everything in your power not to harm them.
Okay.
Now, if you intentionally kill them, that's different.
But
are you hearing me?
But when I kill them to save the plant,
no,
it's
okay,
not my intention.
So you're not being careful. So you are intentionally killing them. So good. Now you're saying that you are intentionally killing them. Well, then you better decide if you want to keep doing that. You value a plant or a sentient being. You'll decide, babe.
What?
I'm serious. If you're asking me the question, I'm giving you the answer. That's your decision. I'm not being rude to you.
But
that's your decision.
Yeah. But there is another question.
Did you hear my answer there?
Yeah,
But I have to kill it to save the plant. You said it clearly.
Yeah.
That's up to you which you prefer, plant or sentient being. I'm not being sarcastic. That's what you to decide. But I'm suggesting there is a way to have plants. Dalai Lama does the garden. There's a way with an attitude of not wanting to harm. It just means you've got to be creative to find other methods, that's all. We're just lazy, that's all. And we're so used to it in our culture thinking you just kill it, you know. You've got to change your mind if you want to. It's up to you. What's your other question?
Okay. It's not a question. It's just another example about killing. So once we took care of a dog and then we came back from a walk. It was just a small dog.
Uh-huh.
And the dog was literally full with ticks.
That's right, exactly.
It was full.
Darling, I understand everybody has his examples. Everybody has his examples. This is just reiterating the suffering of this realm that you can't avoid sentient beings harming each other. So you have to make some choices. I mean, we have to make some decisions. It's not neurotic, it's not obsessive, it's just a brand new idea to us. We just assume, well, you kill the lice, you kill this, you kill the rats, it's okay. And that's coming from our scientific view, they don't have brains, and it's coming from our Christian and Jewish culture, and I'm sorry, that they don't have souls. So the Buddha view, you get brought up with a view never to harm. It's a very different view to grow up with. We are brave enough to begin to change our minds. So start thinking about whether you'd like to develop the view, I don't want to harm anything. That will guide your actions. But don't be neurotic about it. Be brave. But that's up to you, sweetheart.
Mm.
Do you understand me?
Okay.
You sure?
I think so.
You think so?
I hope so.
Just think about it, darling. See, the other point about vows is this. It's very interesting. When you drive a car, I think if you wrote down all the things you're not supposed to do, there'd probably be 100. Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that? Now, you don't say, oh, I'm not going to drive a car, I might speed. Or I'm not going to drive a car, I might forget which road to take. I'm not going to drive a car, I might just forget to put foot on the brake at the right time. You don't say that because you know the advantages of driving a car, so you will learn all the vows. They are vows. I will never I will never speed. I will never go in the wrong direction. I will never go backwards instead of forwards. I'll never put my foot on the brake and the accelerator simultaneously. You've got hundreds of vows. We don't call them vows, and we know that no one's pressuring us to do it. We know that God's not up there going to say you've got to get punished to go to hell if you don't. We know that there is an advantage to driving cars, so we're prepared to learn the vows. It's the same here. We're going to learn the benefits of vows, which is more than what your question is, but I'm answering it in general. Then you'll be happy to learn to keep them. We're big girls and boys. We're grown-ups. We can make decisions, you know. But the reason to do anything is if you know the benefits. So you've got to think of the benefit of wanting to become a non-harming person. You have got to, all of us have to think of, is there a benefit to me of deciding I want to be a non-harming person? Which is the simplest way to put what Buddha's saying. Don't, try not to harm any sentient being. So forget of the benefit to sentient beings. Forget about the benefit to the sentient beings. Think of the benefit to yourself. What kind of person you'd become. An unbelievably kind, sweet person. You're unbelievable. It would be unbelievable to having the aspiration to be a non-harming person. Think about the benefit of that for you. Do you get my point?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Question, please. About high school again, the mind. Back to high school, please. Where are you? Yep. Yep.
So you gave the example about Lama Zopa Rinpoche drowning and being able to, because he had experienced emptiness in a past life.
Realized it. Seen the truth
so
of it.
Our,
stable in his
yes,
mind.
Our ability to logically hold the concept of emptiness, how is that different, us knowing?
It's conceptual. Not experiential. It's
right.
Like knowing the recipe but not knowing the taste of the cake. That's
right.
The difference.
So is that, how does that fit into the concept, the structure of the mind?
Conceptual. Start with conceptual.
So the perception.
Then it goes to experiential.
Experiential.
Perception just means experiential.
Okay.
You know the truth of it. And we get that in a general sense in our daily life. You can start learning the theory of music and then you play it. And that's the example of experiential, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
That's all. You know the recipe, but now you've tasted the cake. The recipe is the conceptual, and that's the level we live at. Then we, in meditation, going to a subtler level, or even just in daily life, you can start to put meat on the bones of that concept and start to become a real experience. Even a little bit, we get an experience of impermanence. That's experiential. That's more than just conceptual. We still live mostly at the conceptual level, but at a subtler level in meditation, which we never touch because we haven't got samadhi,
right,
then we can really taste the actual truth of it.
Right.
It's only a concept that we can have to just imagine that, you know?
Right.
That's the idea.
And that's kind of the proof of the Buddha mind, like that we all, that's intrinsic in our nature, that we're able to even hold that concept. Proof that...
I mean, I can usually say yes, but it's not quite right what you're saying, so mm-hmm. Just say it again and let's discuss it.
The proof of the ability to hold that concept in our minds.
Well, best is to say what you're just saying is the proof that our mind can change, which is the logic for why we can become a Buddha.
Yes. Will you say that again, please?
Okay. What you just said is that our ability to go, you know, learn something conceptually and get an experience of it
mm-hmm.
is the proof that we can change our mind, which is the proof, finally, that we can rid the mind of all delusions. Because change your mind is the process of ridding the mind of all delusions, which proves Buddhahood. That's your Buddha nature, yes.
Yes.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Okay,
thank
yes.
you for
any that. Questions? Any more questions? Any more questions? Any more questions? Then we can go for lunch.
Right. I have to ask.
Where are you?
I'm here.
Where are you? Yes, sweetie. Yes, darling. Yeah.
With respect to what the lady was saying regarding the ticks and the dog and your comment about the fact that our goal is to be...
Our wish to become a non-harming
wish,
person.
Yes, no harm.
But God that guides us in all our actions. Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
So in her case,
she
would have to choose between the lives of the ticks.
We have an assumption you either kill or you don't plant. But if we're intelligent and creative, we are creative and very intelligent, we can think of other methods to attempt not to harm sentient beings as much as we can. We're creative. And people come up with all kinds of methods of not killing in planting in gardens, I've heard. What I'm saying is, Lama Zopa says everything starts on the tip of the wish, which is intention. So the intention we're describing here that we maybe would like to cultivate, I'm going to decide that I want to be a non-harming person. So that becomes your decision that guides every action. So when you get to meet that ant in your sink, suddenly, once you would have let it go down the sink, now you'll think, oh my goodness, I'll see if I can save it. You mightn't save it, but you'll try to save it.
Yeah.
Another time you'll see the mouse and try and not harm it. Another time you drive in the car, you know that the beans are splatting on your windscreen, so you're going to find methods, even though you know you can't avoid that. You're not intentionally killing them, but you know it's going to happen. Everybody drives cars, and on the number plate, trillions. So we do the best we can to mitigate that by having compassion, by maybe purifying as we go. I wish I didn't have to harm sentient beings, because you can't avoid it. Whether we're walking, we're going to harm sentient beings. So it becomes a decision that then drives the way you think. it leads you in those directions. And then when you live in a vow not to kill, this purifies our tendency to kill, and it will purify our experience, which means we won't meet so many sentient beings. All I can say is, since I've been a Buddhist for 43 years, I've had a vow not to kill, I've yet never met a situation in which I've been forced to kill, ever. That's due to karma and due to keeping vows, I think. And that's just the merit I have. I mean, I've never done a garden. I've never had a wish to do a garden. I've never had a, bought a house that has, you know, I've never had a kitchen. So, I mean, I avoid all those things because I don't have to encroach. You understand? So having houses and mortgages and houses that have ants that eat them and flowers that plants eat, creatures eat, I've never had any of those things. So I avoid having to kill. But I'm just talking, that driven by the mind, our intention, and vows have the infinite power of purifying even our need to kill. Communicating or not?
Yes.
You can't give a black and white answer. You've got to think of the meaning of this intention and how that guides you. And then when you live in a vow, Buddha says it's so potent. It's in the mind stream 24 hours, and it purifies your tendency to kill or lie or steal, whatever the vow is. So it's a powerful way to consciously live a moral life and to protect us from harming as much as we can.
Understand.
That's the point. We can't make it perfect.
Another question.
Yeah.
Throughout the time that I have been here, in and out of the center, I have never been able to answer this question that has been bothering me.
What's the question?
You mentioned the example of, our happiness and unhappiness.
Like, what, darling? What?
Regarding our happiness, the source of our happiness and unhappiness, when it is like you said something about Mary being the cause of our happiness.
Yes.
If she gives us $20 and unhappiness,
yes,
if she takes it back.
Yeah. Or if she's the cause of our unhappiness, if she steals from us.
Right.
Example.
Yeah,
simple,
right.
Example. Yeah. Then.
So I try to not do fall into that
trap. That's right.
You know? But right. I've been asking this question for a long time. I cannot seem to be able to do this with Trump. I hate that man. I'm sorry, but he is the source of my unhappiness.
I understand, darling. No, no. It's really not that complicated. You see, the point here is we have an assumption. If we see a person harming another, a person harming, not even me, just person harming, you might be right that they are harming. There's no argument. You see, this, when Buddha says that my main suffering is my anger about the person harming, that doesn't mean that the person's not harming. He is harming.
Yeah.
Maybe Mr. Trump is harming. He is lying. He is racist. He is sexist. Let's just say that's true. That is not the issue here. He is doing that. But sort of Buddha saying, well, that's his problem. Your problem is your anger about him. So get rid of your anger and he won't harm you anymore. And he's still harming, but he's not going to harm you.
Yes, but then the problem is that if I do not get angry, then I feel that
I know.
That I am ignoring the problem.
No, no. See, that's our view. In our culture, we conflate action with anger. But when anger is an over-exaggeration of his role in upsetting you. So when you've got anger is also thwarted attachment. This is a more subtle thing. Why we get angry is because attachment, the junkie in us, only wants to see and meet and taste and touch and smell things that make me happy. So you meet a person who doesn't make you happy, your attachment has them a panic attack, and then anger arises. How dare he not make me happy? So the real cause of anger internally is attachment to get what I want. So the root of it is when I get rid of attachment to get what I want, I will be free. I'll be able to see crystal clear people harming others. Then I can practice the compassion wing and never give up helping, but not driven by attachment and not driven by anger, but driven by compassion and wisdom.
You're trying to tell me to be compassionate to this man?
Yeah. That's not what I said. No, I did not say that yet. It is being said later, but this point I've just made now is not the point yet. When we can, in our culture, we don't have a view that says you can get rid of attachment and anger. So we assume that we have to have those. So then, of course, within the view that you have got, which is a typical worldly view, if I get rid of anger, we think we just get rid of the baby, we just throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we get rid of caring. I can see that that's really how we think. No, you just get rid of the disturbed mind. You get rid of your agitation. You get rid of your distress. You get rid of your neediness. You get rid of your anxiety. Then you can see clearly what is happening and you want to then help the world. That's compassion. And you'll retain your own happiness. But you'll see the maniacs. You won't have anger towards them because you also have the view of karma, which causes you to know why they're harming. So you'll do what you can to help the world change. But it won't be coming from attachment. It won't be coming from anger. It'll come from compassion and wisdom and enthusiasm and clarity. And you'll never give up. As Martin Luther King said, it's good to see problems. But then you say, how can I help? Whereas anger says, smash, kick, punch. Are we communicating?
Somewhat.
The key, darling, is to understand the Buddhist analysis of attachment and anger as things that are unnecessary, that they're causes. They are the source of my pain. It doesn't mean there aren't racists and murderers and psychos out there. There are. So get rid of your neuroses, get rid of your attachment and your neediness and your panic-stricken eye. You are powerful and brave and compassionate and wise, and you'll never give up helping others, ever. And you'll always be happy. That's what Buddha's saying. It's not how we talk in the West. Are we communicating?
Yes. Somewhat.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Okay. We'll keep talking after lunch.
Thank you.
Time for lunch. We've still got university and postgraduate left. But we have way more of high school to talk about, way more about the mind. We've got to rub our noses even deeper in attachment yet. We haven't even begun. All right? Please don't rub your noses in lunch now. Please think of lunch different. Now, just a second, a little quick analysis. All Buddha's doing is saying we've got to see things differently, have different interpretations. Let's reinterpret lunch. Normally, interpretation of lunch is attachment. Okay? So here we're going to have the interpretation of there's no inherent emptiness. There's no inherent lunch there. The carrots and the tomatoes and the lentils and the beans and the olives and the bread, they're labels we give to that stuff on a plate. The meaning comes from our mind, not there. That's the ultimate meaning of emptiness. We'll go into this. So we think there's, you know, from its own side there's nothing. We imagine there's oceans of it. We bless it with all the energy of the body, speech and mind of all the holy beings. Om Mah Hum, Om Mah Hum, Om Mah Hum. Then we think of all the beings in the universe. We offer, if we could. And we see them all experience the joy of receiving it. Lama Sangha Lama Chöde Lama Gerente Kungi Depo Lama Te Lama Namna Chöpabu. And then once you've done that, so powerful you've changed your motivation for eating into virtue, the bigger your stomach, the better. As Lama Zopa said. So go and enjoy. And discuss this stuff. Rip it apart. And I'll see you in 90 minutes.